listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. How are you today, Mom?
I'm good. I don't know if we're going to hear it in the morning or the afternoon, but
well, that is true.
Anyway,
that is
have
true.
A good day. Have a good day, everybody, whatever it is.
And we have a really interesting novel to share today.
Yes.
Do you want to introduce our guest, Mom?
Okay, do I have his Namath? Is that how you pronounce your last name, Mike?
I use the long E, Namath.
Namath, okay. And Mike Namath is a novelist, blogger, former AAU basketball coach, and retired information technology executive. The Undiscovered Country is the sequel to Defiled, a crime fiction thriller, which became a best-selling book on Amazon. Mike's other works include 128 billion to one, a nonfiction examination of March Madness, the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship Tournament. Mike lives in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, with his wife, Angie, and their rescue dog, Sophie. And this book is amazing. It really is, Mike.
Well, thank you for that. That's a mouthful. Yes, and I'm glad to be with you today, coming to you from Atlanta. Monica, I guess you must be somewhere in the Austin, Texas area?
You might think so, based on my phone number. It's a Skype number, and so I'm actually in Iowa, just down the road from my mother, but I do spend a lot of time in Austin.
My father was in Iowa, So we won't digress. I really appreciate your time today and happy to talk all you want about The Undiscovered Country.
Well, there's a lot to talk about because it's there's so much in it. It's just, I just couldn't put it down. That's the truth. I just read it. And, I was engrossed in everything because I have had dealings with, the medical viewing thing, and my husband was in, he is on dialysis for 8 years, and then he had several other things that had tension, and I tried to be there as much as I could, and it's difficult.
Mike, is this your first book?
No, it's actually my second novel. I guess it's my fourth book, second novel. So I've written some nonfiction as well, but I've learned that nonfiction writing is really, really hard work, and novels, on the other hand, are a lot of fun, at least for me. So this is the second one, and some of the characters carry forth from the first book, which was called Defiled, to this second book, The Undiscovered Country, including the protagonist. So Randall Marks is my anti-hero, and I challenge him with things that we find in our daily lives, social issues that I think people should become more aware of. But I wrap it up in interesting crime thrillers so that it's an entertaining read for the reader, but yet hopefully gives people pause to think about common circumstances like a parent who becomes critically ill.
I think you, in your first book, you kind of alluded to the fact that we were going to meet him again in another book, right?
Well, to be fair, I left the reader hanging just a bit at the end of the first book, and I've done it again at the end of the second book.
Right. So I'm going to be interested to see how that comes out. Have you started that book yet?
I am working on it now, as the two of you know for sure. The publishing industry moves rather slowly. So I wrote the first novel in 2013. It got published in 2016. I wrote The Undiscovered Country in 2016, and it's being released this coming Tuesday.
Wow, so it's brand new. We're one of the first to read it then.
You actually are.
Oh, that's That's great.
I have a niece and a daughter, both of whom have read both books, who are now whipping me like a mule every day to get the third one written because I left them hanging just a bit at the end of the second one.
That's what happens when you write a series, and you have to keep going because your audience is on the cusp, they're poised, and they want to know what's going to happen. So.
Exactly. To be clear, though, you can actually read either of the two books individually, and you don't have to read them in sequence in order to get the full benefit of the stories. They are standalone novels that happen to be about the same lead character and the challenges that I cause him to face.
But it did make me, when I was reading this one, it did make me very curious about the other book because of some of the things that, some references to what happened in his earlier life, that he, you know, ended up in prison and obviously had some real issues with his ex-wife. And so now I want to know more. How much of you is in this character?
Not as much as I would like. I think all the characters are composites from all the people that I've met in my very long life, and I've had a blessed life where I've been able to travel the world from a working perspective and meet a whole lot of different kinds of people in different cultures and learn a lot of things. So the characters are all composites, but Randall, my lead character, is the kind of guy that I think a lot more of us should be. He instinctively questions authority. He doesn't take things at face value. He challenges the status quo. And people like that cause our civilization to evolve. We don't get static. We don't sit still. And people like that are also, in another way, very troublesome for people who are comfortable in their current status quo.
He sometimes takes it a little far, doesn't he?
You know, one of the hardest things about writing fiction is knowing how far to go. I didn't know if I had made my antagonist, what should I call her, evil enough. I didn't know if I had made Randall, the protagonist, good enough or relatable enough or lovable enough. And so it's feedback from readers that really lets an author know whether he's hit the mark or not. But that's a very difficult balance to achieve.
Yes, I imagine it is. You know, you in this undiscovered country, the matriarch of the family, who's Randall's mother, is dying, and you began writing this book after your own mother passed away, correct?
Yes, my mother passed away in 2014. Actually, the part of her circumstance that really led me to want to write the book happened way back in 2011. She suffered a very serious heart attack at an advanced age. Nobody thought she was going to survive, but she was a very strong-willed woman, a fighter, is what we usually call those people. And she, not only did she survive, but she ended up living independently for 3.5 more years.
Oh.
And they were actually the best years of our lives. You know, when you know the end could come at any moment, I think it adds to how you treasure those moments. And, you know, we were probably more honest with one another during that time. Learned more about one another than we had in our parent-children relationships. I also have two siblings, and I just think it was sort of a miracle for us that she survived, and then we had those 3 years to really strengthen the bonds that we had in the family. So her circumstance turned out to be much better than than poor Elaine in my novel. But I drew on that experience factually and emotionally to help drive the story.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, that's that was and she was a strong character in this book too.
Yes, yes, yes. I don't know how much contact you've had or how much time you might have spent in the South, but she's a very Southern woman who is very proper in her external life, and yet on the inside is fierce, feisty, strong-willed. And I've known many a Southern belle who is exactly like that.
Okay. No, I don't. I had a friend who lived in North Carolina, but and I have another friend who's lived there for several years, but she was a classmate of mine. And I think she's pretty strong-willed, too. But, this is, now you're in the Deep South, what they call the Deep South, right, in Georgia?
You know, there's not really very much of the Old South or Deep South left in the country. We've all become pretty well homogenized, I think. So this book is set in Augusta specifically because you can still get some of that flavor in Augusta and in Columbia, South Carolina as well. So there are a few scenes in Columbia. And I chose them specifically because They're almost last bastions of the real South. Atlanta, as an example, is exactly the opposite. It's the new South. You can't tell Atlanta from Dallas unless you read a road sign.
Oh.
So that old tradition, old culture is slowly being homogenized. I'm sure you know if you travel the United States today, an awful lot of places look like just where you came from.
Yep, that's true. That's true.
We all have the same stores, the same shopping centers, the same ways of doing things. So there just aren't really that many places left that are different or clinging to days gone by.
Well, that's an interesting observation. I haven't really traveled the United States that much since I ended up in Iowa. I lived in Virginia, right across from Washington D.C. After I was married, then moved to Pennsylvania, then California, back to Pennsylvania, then to Iowa. So started in Iowa. People are people, and They're pretty much the same wherever you go. There are good people, and there are people that you want to avoid.
I was interested in
your book. You one of your characters, who was Randall's sister, is addicted to drugs, and that's something that a lot of families face these days. Is that why you?
It is. I'm sorry.
Is that why you did that? Is that why you had her character, so that you could bring that particular problem in?
I did. I was writing the book right as I think we became suddenly and unfortunately aware of the opioid crisis in America. And in the book, I trace a little bit of her history for how that happened to her. As maybe a little bit of a warning to other people. Opioids are illegal and not used in this household. And, I hope we never have to. But they're extraordinarily dangerous, and I don't think anybody knew exactly how dangerous they were until the crisis was full-blown.
No, I agree. I think doctors were prescribing them and, people were taking them, and that's very true. And it's interesting how it does explode it all at once, and then people realize, oh my gosh, am I addicted? When they've been taking these things. So, yeah. Well, the medical community is interesting. Just like anything else, there are people in it who are very, very good, and people who aren't. And so we have to navigate all of that. But in this book, the character navigates the medical community that is taking care of his mother, and that's a very difficult thing for him.
It is. He gets some help in the book from the hospitalist. So, you know, we're in an age of specialists, right? And Randall's mother has half a dozen specialists looking at various different things. But there's another doctor called a hospitalist who is sort of the glue for that team, who holds the team together, who facilitates communication among those team members. What I've found in my own personal experience is that the specialists are so singularly focused in their area that they may or may not know a lot about the medicine in somebody else's area. You know, a doctor is not a doctor anymore. A doctor is now a specialist. So I had a circumstance where a family member went to a heart specialist, and when he looked at her list of prescriptions, he admitted to us that he had no idea what half of them even were, and or their interactions with other drugs that he might want to prescribe. So even in our personal lives, we sort of need that linchpin, if you will, who knows our whole medical history, who can facilitate communication among specialists and so forth. But as we advance in the medical arena, as we add technology and capability and, you know, new drugs, et cetera, we actually expose ourselves to things we were never exposed to when the good doctors used to make house calls.
Oh my goodness, that's for sure. Yeah. Well, fortunately,
It's really sort of counterintuitive, but advancements in technology and so forth actually give us more ethical problems than we ever had before, that most of us in our civilian lives are not very well equipped to deal with.
Well, in this town, we have a hospital and some very good doctors. Several of them are retiring, and the one who's a neighbor of mine and a good friend of mine is retiring, and he was a pharmacist before he became a doctor. So he kind of knows a little more about pharmaceuticals. Yeah.
So, Mike, there's a lot of medical information in this book. What is your background, or how did you learn enough to write this?
A few things, actually. I'm also in a neighborhood surrounded by doctors. So I had some coaching, with the Wikipedia and other resources online. You can do a lot that way. And then, again, my mother's circumstance, I chose Elaine's medical condition to be similar to my mother's, so that my brother and I had taken copious notes during that entire episode. So I had a stack of notes about what this drug did and what that drug did and what this treatment might be next. I've had people tell me, your reaction would be interesting to me, but I've had people tell me that I balanced the medical detail pretty well with not overwhelming the reader. The reader hopefully doesn't have to go back to the internet and research something to find out what the heck I was talking about.
Oh, yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Did you then have like a medical professional read through it to make sure that you didn't mess up anywhere?
I didn't. But there are medical people who've read the book since then. My daughter is a nurse, as an example. So I haven't had anybody say, "Oh, you really goofed it on page 139."
Now, the medical profession is not coming off as very as exactly heroic in this book. Did you get any pushback on that?
No, not really, because I think it's fairly factual, and it's somewhat personality driven. You know, it turns out that the doctor who had the least bedside manner was the doctor who was actually right. You know, and I did that intentionally. Sometimes I know even in my own family, people tend to go to doctors that they like on a personal level. And I think we have to be careful with that. The good bedside manner isn't always an indicator of proficiency, and a bad bedside manner isn't always an indicator that he's a bad doctor. You know, all kinds of people have become doctors for all kinds of different reasons. But I think I stuck to the facts. I think they're represented factually, although on a personal level, we might like some of the doctors in the book better than others.
Well, just like we like some of the characters better than others.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mike Nemeth, author of The Undiscovered Country, a novel. So what prompted you really, like, I'm assuming these novels kind of started with the character, with Randall Marx. Is that where the ideas came, the whole concept of the books, of the two books, and, you know, you've got a third one coming? With him, or was there something, or was it more plot driven to begin with?
I actually say neither one. the way I work is I start with a theme. So the theme in Defiled is that justice under the law and fairness are not always synonymous, right? I think we've all had the experience of having some legal issue and going to a lawyer with a concept in our own minds of what would be a fair outcome, and then getting that crushing reaction from the lawyer who says, yeah, sorry, but that's not the law. The law is actually this other thing, and it's different, and you're not going to get the outcome that you were looking for. You're going to get something a little bit different from that. So that was the theme of Defiled. And then the theme of The Undiscovered Country is really kind of twofold: medical ethics on the one hand, and unfortunately the indignity of aging and dying in America on the other hand. So I start with a reason to write the book and a point I want to make in the book, and then I plot a story that will make that point, right? And, you know, I write a genre that's normally referred to as crime fiction, which means an anti-hero struggles against faceless institutions for moral superiority. That's like a textbook definition. So I needed an anti-hero. So the characters sort of came third. And Randall is a vehicle to tell the story, and all the other characters in the book are really vehicles to help Randall tell that story.
So I've never heard that definition of crime fiction before. Could you repeat that?
Sure. Crime fiction is an anti-hero struggling against faceless institutions for moral superiority.
And I think that's exactly what you created.
I was actually surprised to learn that when I learned that the first time. You know, I might have thought of it as a mystery, but the experts in the industry say, no, sir, you are writing crime fiction.
Well, there was certainly a lot of history for Randall in his life. I mean, a lot of he had to go through a lot growing up, and that adds to the whole mystery of his character and the whole mystery of the story, really.
I actually received a call from a reader this morning who said, I hope you're going to give Randall a break in the third book.
Well, yes, you know, I hope so too.
It's, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but what he finds out about his background in this book, it seems like, did you know that when you were writing the first book that he had this these issues in his childhood?
I knew he had issues in his childhood. And in the second book, I wanted to look for a reason for that. You know, I hate characters who are, they're just bad people, you know, and there's no further explanation but that they're bad people. They're psychopaths or sociopaths or what have you. And the writer just leaves us with that, and we're supposed to sort of accept that as enough of an explanation. So I knew in the second book, his childhood needed an explanation, and the one that's in the second book is the explanation I came up with.
Well, I think it explains an awful lot about not just his character, but some of the other characters too. So it was good.
And yet I still left people hanging at the end of the book.
Yes, you did.
So in the third book, there has to be an answer.
So, Mike, when did you actually begin writing? Is it something that you've done all your life, or did it something that you started later in life?
Well, I never wrote for commercial publication until I was nearing retirement. I began writing seriously, I guess, in 2013. As I neared retirement, but I have written all my life. I actually wrote a novel as a very young man and piled up a file folder full of rejection slips. But in my professional life, I wrote a lot. So I wrote articles for trade magazines and advertising copy and all kinds of things like that, nonfiction articles about business. So I had a lot of experience writing. I write easily. I don't fear sitting at the typewriter. It's been a part of my life. And I always knew that I would come back to it and try to become a commercial author. It's sort of a lifelong dream.
Well, now that first novel, you still have that first novel? That when you were young, when you wrote,
I don't. I know what it is, but I no longer have the manuscript. It was a really long time and a lot of places ago.
Well, I was going to say, you might be able to rework that, you know, because it might have had some, you know, pearls of wisdom in it or something. You really, you know, that's...
Now, Mike, you mentioned you didn't have any fear of sitting in front of a typewriter, but are you still writing on a typewriter?
No, that was a euphemism. No, I'll tell you, one of the most amazing things that I've learned is how many resources I can easily tap into now that people like Hemingway, who literally sat at a typewriter, weren't able to tap into. I made a pilgrimage to Key West and saw his writing room this past summer or last summer. And I'm just amazed. I couldn't possibly write without all those resources, without a laptop, without the internet, Wikipedia, et cetera, et cetera. It's email to people asking questions and so forth. I use a legal service, actually, where I can ask lawyers questions about legal issues. And then, you know, within hours, they come back with advice. You know, Hemingway had none of that at his fingertips. He literally sat at a typewriter and tried never to have to use whiteout, which is just incredible to me. So the gap in talent is pretty darn significant.
Is Hemingway your hero?
You know, I think sort of on a personal level, he is. I'm fascinated by his life. He's not a favorite when it comes to reading novels. But I like all the guys from his era as sort of a collection of people who are worth our admiration. So F. Scott Fitzgerald, Thomas Wolfe, William Faulkner. I make an annual pilgrimage to Faulkner House in New Orleans, where he wrote his first novel. It's now a bookstore, one of my favorites. And so I really, really admire those guys, but I don't read any of them.
I actually enjoy reading about them a lot, too. Right now I'm reading Everyone Behaved Badly, which is about Hemingway and writing The Sun Also Rises. And I just find the story behind those books really fascinating.
I do too. That's what I like about them more than what they've actually written. I have a lot of other people whom I admire because I enjoy reading them.
Who are some of the writers that you enjoy reading?
William Goldman. You might not recognize the name, but a couple of things that got made into movies, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, was his movie, Marathon Man, the one with the evil dentist, was actually a William Goldman book. But he wrote a book early in his career called Boys and Girls Together that really had an effect on me personally. I read it as a very young man. And I thought to myself, I'd certainly love to be able to write something like that. The Naked and the Dead by Norman Mailer was another book that I read very early in my life that had a tremendous effect on me and kind of pointed me in this direction. But the guys I read today, Martin Cruz Smith, whom you might know from Gorky Park, but he wrote a lot of other things as well. A gentleman named Joseph Cannon with a K, who writes sort of historical fiction set in wonderful places in the world. And so I can really immerse myself in the things that he writes, are two of my current go-to guys.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Mike Nemeth, author of The Undiscovered Country, a novel. Mike, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us today?
I can. I'll read you one of my favorite passages. It might take just a moment. I'm actually holding the book in my hand.
Okay, well, while you're looking for that, Mom, I know that you really got into this book, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I really did.
Why? Yeah. What is it about it, do you think, that appealed to you so much?
Well, one thing I enjoyed was that the there's quite a bit of dialogue in it and not so much narration. And that, you know, that's to me really is what drove it and kept me going, because the characters really seemed like they were alive, and you know,
there was a lot of realism to it. You know,
it's a
situation you can imagine yourself finding yourself in.
That's right.
For me, it was interesting because I'm actually involved in helping with someone's estate right now, and so I saw some of the parallels of things going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, and I, you know, saw the parallels between what I had experienced with Ron in the hospital, you know?
Right, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mike, are you ready?
I am. So this is a scene, and I want to come back to the heavy on dialogue before we wrap up. I think that's a really interesting point. But anyway, this is a scene in Elaine's hospital room. So Randall is in the room with his mother, and there's a nurse called Shelby who's with them in the room. So here we go. As Shelby wiped a drop of water from Mom's chin, an army of medical practitioners crowded into the room. Metzger, he's the cardiac surgeon, led the invasion, followed by Ms. Schmidt. She's the social worker, who peeled off and leaned against the wall next to the door. Kaplan, he's the hospitalist. Kaplan, looking sheepish, entered with a tall, bespectacled doctor, I assume to be Neiman, the ophthalmologist. Trailing behind was a 40-ish doctor with patchy black hair. That had to be Rosenberg, the neurologist. At the last moment, Harrison, the immunologist, ducked in the door, completing the team. Ms. Schmidt crossed her arms and adopted a haughty expression like that teacher you hated in fourth grade. Metzger spoke for the group, which was uniformly tense. We don't think you understand your mother's prognosis, Mr. Marks. We're all here to answer your questions, but I'll summarize for you. The heart attack damaged her heart, and it's barely pumping. She has a faulty mitral valve that will undoubtedly trigger another attack, and she won't survive it. She's blind, and that's a very scary situation for her. She's had several strokes, and they were likely connected to the heart attack. I glanced at Rosenberg, and he cocked his head as though to say, maybe. Everyone turned toward the door then as Billy, that's Randall's brother, shouldered his way into the room. Beth, who is Billy's wife, was left standing in the hallway. Billy had the good sense to listen before speaking. Metzger resumed his summation. The fluid that had built up in her legs has now found its way to her lungs. If that isn't reversed, we won't have to wait for another AFib episode. The pneumonia will end her life. And we've just discovered that she has a strep infection that could be fatal. I glanced at Harrison, the immunologist. He shrugged. Metzger was going to continue, but I cut him off. I know she's sick, doctor. She's very, very sick, Mr. Marks, and we can't operate. The best thing would be to move her to a hospice where she can be cared for, a place where the family can make her last days comfortable. Metzger was fortunate I wasn't holding a weapon. He saw my fury and held up a hand. Sign the DNR, Mr. Marks. Save yourself the agony of life support and decisions about pulling the plug. He gestured to Ms. Schmidt, who nodded. She had obviously organized this lynch party. I waited for my body to return to a normal temperature. The group probably thought I was considering Metzger's recommendation. I was not. As the tallest person in the room, I had a perch from which to deliver my response. This is a living, breathing, thinking, and feeling human being, I said, pointing to my mother. Assuming God has a plan, we're all tools for his purposes. Your role, as skilled tools, is to heal that human being until his will overrides your skill. It's not your prerogative to make decisions for him, and it's sure as hell not my job either.
Yep.
It was kind of, it seemed throughout this that they weren't really listening to what his mother wanted at all. That the doctors never even bothered to ask her.
Yes, well, and in fact, pretty much everyone ignores her, and it's one of the points I wanted to make about what happens when elderly people become ill. The doctors want to do their thing. The children want to save their parents' life or otherwise exert their will, if you will, on what happens going forward. And the person who tends to be ignored is the patient.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right.
Wow.
That's
and it's true,
because it?
Randall didn't really ask his mom either what she wanted.
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. He actually feels pretty bad about it later, but he kept pushing her along for... the usual reaction that we have, which is we need to keep our parents alive no matter what, no matter what we make them go through.
And he was also driven by the wanting to know what in the world has happened to her resources and who's responsible for that and so forth, right?
Exactly, yes. She wanted to keep her secrets, and he wanted to know what those secrets really were.
Yeah. Well, it makes for a mystery, and at the same time, I mean, it's just it had, I don't know how to explain it, but it had a lot of factors that made it a most interesting book, and I hope it does well because it's a good one.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Mike Nemeth, author of The Undiscovered Country. Mike, tell us a little bit about your path to publication.
As I mentioned earlier, most of the publications in my life were business articles in trade magazines and trade newspapers and so forth until 2013. So I began writing Defiled, the first book, and then now we have The Undiscovered Country. I've also written a nonfiction book since then called 128 Billion to One, which is for sports fans. 128 billion to one are the odds against filling a perfect bracket for March Madness, the NCAA basketball tournament. So every year we all fill out our brackets. Every year we are all wrong, and there are actual good reasons for why that's the case. And this summer, in August, there's a companion book about college football called Lies, Damn Lies, and Statistics, which is the Mark Twain quote, because we don't really understand the game of college football. I have a lot of statistical analysis to show that it's actually a very different game from the one we think we're watching.
Now, oh, that's quite different from the topic of your novels.
Yeah, those are hobby things. But as I might have said early in the conversation, nonfiction is just really hard work. The fact checking, the attributions, the permissions for quotations, the making sure you're not people. It's really, really hard work.
So to relax, you write novels.
I do, yes.
So this, your novels are published by Morgan James Fiction. Is this, I believe it's a form of self-publishing?
They're a hybrid publisher. They do everything every other, well-known publisher, HarperCollins, et cetera, does. Except the marketing side of things. Authors are pretty much on their own to do what I'm doing today, and to make sure the book sells. But otherwise, they're just like a normal publisher. All the books are distributed through exactly the same channels to exactly the same stores and so forth. So they're only slightly different. And the dirty little truth is that, or the dirty little secret is that, the traditional publishers are no longer doing very much marketing unless your name happens to be, John Grisham or somebody like that.
So
there's not a whole heck of a lot of difference anymore.
Does this publisher also edit? Do they have editors that provide the editing services and the cover design and the layout and all of that?
All of that, yes, all of that. They do all of that. They produce a really nice physical product, distribute through Ingram. And another thing that I really like about them is a portion of the proceeds go to Habitat for Humanity.
I saw that on the back cover that they were partnering
with
Habitat for Humanity. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so we get to give back just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So did you try and get an agent and go with a traditional publisher, or did you go straight to the independent version?
No, it's all pretty much an accident. I had assumed I was going to look for an agent. It's sort of what everybody does. But I ran into one of the Morgan James editors at a book show, and she said, no, send me your manuscript. I'll show you an easier way.
And you've been happy with the results?
Very, very happy. But, you know, to be fair, I employ a publicist to help me with the marketing side of things. And so I have a stake in the game, if you will.
Because I
have to cover the portion that they don't do.
Right. And of course, this is much easier to do now because you don't have to buy 5,000 copies of the book up front, like in the old days.
Correct. The publicist that I employ also is really, really good. And that was another thing that was just pretty much lucky. Because there are an awful lot of people out there who want to help authors, but don't do all that well at helping authors. And, I think unfortunately a lot of authors waste a lot of money, trying to become noticed. And, my publicist has just really been a blessing.
And that's, JKS?
Right. JKS Communications. Yep.
Yes. And that's how you found us was through them. And we work with,
exactly.
I work with probably three or four of their publicists, to find authors and have been very pleased with the authors that they've brought us.
Yes. Yes. I love those people. Pretty much literally. They're really good at their work. They're really good people. And they give me an excuse to travel to New Orleans.
Ah. Sounds like New Orleans is one of your favorite places.
It is. And, it's going to be featured in the third book.
I was just going to ask that if you had thought about setting a book there.
Yeah. So the book starts in Atlanta, and I plan to have it end in New Orleans.
Now, Defiled, I think, was mostly set in Florida.
Correct.
Because that's where Randall was before. So did you live there?
I did. I lived in St. Pete Beach for a number of years, and, So I knew the location very, very well. I've lived most of my life here in Atlanta, and I'm here now because our families are all around us here. But St. Pete Beach, Florida holds a special place in my heart, and that's why it was the first location I chose. But New Orleans is pretty special, too, and it'll be in book number 3.
Now, when you're writing a book, do you treat it like a job? Are you writing every day? Do you have set times, or are you looser about it?
No. I have always treated it as a job. My wife, bless her heart, treats it as a job, and has respect for it, which is very, very helpful. So I go to work at 7 a.m. every morning. On weekends, I treat myself. I quit by noon.
And how long do you work during the week?
Generally about 8 hours a day.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
But once you begin writing a novel, it's in your blood, it's in your brain, and so we might be watching TV and I'll really be thinking, what is that character going to do next?
Do your characters ever surprise you, Mike?
Oh, always. So, you know, by the time you are about probably halfway through the book, they're in charge. You just can't let them get out of character. You can't force them to do things that they wouldn't have done if they were real people. And so you have to begin to follow their lead to the end, after you've gotten them well developed, set up the premise of the book and gotten the initial conflicts on paper, the characters are in charge.
Well, in Undiscovered Country, there are a couple of twists, fairly surprising ones. Did you know when you started writing that was how things would go?
Without giving anything away, the very last twist I didn't know was going to happen.
I didn't either.
And now it's become an important part of book number three.
Okay, that makes sense.
I'm curious, when before you wrote Defiled, did you know somebody who had been unjustly accused, or how did you decide on that particular theme for your first book?
Yeah, unfortunately, I knew a lot of people who had gotten caught up in the legal system in one way or another, you know, no capital crimes, but had gotten caught up and just found it to be so different from what we imagined it would be. You know, we watch television and we think we know what the justice system is going to be like. And there actually are some television programs and movies that do a pretty good job. But when you're actually in it, it can be completely different from anything you imagined. And I wanted to sort of capture that sense that, oh my gosh, it can't possibly be this way. Oh my gosh, I can't possibly be in this much trouble. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do? You know, the justice system is not a warm and fuzzy thing.
Right. And sometimes that happens. That happens, what you're describing, happens to people before they realize what's going on. You know, they find themselves in that position.
Well, and if it weren't that way, we wouldn't even have shows like Dateline in 2020, right? All of the stories are about people who are trying to figure out what the heck to do about their legal situation.
Mm-hmm. Right, and, you know, like your character had resources, but there are a lot of people who get swept up into the justice system who have no resources to fight back or to do anything about it, and they get lost.
I don't want to misuse the term, but we hear words like railroaded, sold down the river, and that can be exactly the feeling if you don't have the constitution or the resources to help yourself.
Right.
I've been hearing a lot lately about how frequently accused people are encouraged by their court-appointed attorneys to plead guilty because they don't let them out on bail, and they lose their jobs and everything. You know, they basically don't have a choice but to plead guilty in order to sometimes get out for time served, but now they're convicted, even if they didn't do it.
Yes. Well, in just plain wrongful convictions, you know, I went to the University of Wisconsin and the Innocence Project. Thank you. Was started at the University of Wisconsin by law school students. And so DNA, testing has now overturned many, many convictions. And just as you were saying, many, many people are incarcerated because they sort of had no choice, or it was the only good choice they had to save their family or to avoid further pain or greater pain, negotiate a sentence and go to prison. The legal system could use some change. You know, it's based upon a system we started in the 1700s when we were a small, provincial, agricultural, sparsely populated set of 13 colonies, predicated upon old systems from old England, and never really rethought. And so we have today a system that just doesn't always work.
So, Mike, in book one, you take on the criminal justice system. In book two, you take on the medical system. What are you taking on in book three?
The unfettered, untethered, unmanaged march of technology.
Oh my! is artificial intelligence part of that?
It is. Artificial intelligence, robotics, outsourcing. You know, our middle class is in critical condition. We systematically have been getting rid of the jobs that good middle class people have held for years, the jobs that coming out of World War II made us a tremendous economy and a world-class country. And those jobs are all going away. And the ones that are sort of insidiously going away that we don't sort of notice or worry about are the ones that are being taken over by technology and outsourcing. We just sort of feel like as long as it's an advancement in technology, it must be good and it's inevitable. And we're just going to keep moving forward without really sort of thinking through the repercussions and what does it really mean to our country if middle class people can no longer hold jobs. We won't be a country if that comes true. And so, you know, the theme is sort of where do these dangers come from? What are the attitudes around this sort of thing? I spent my life in high technology. I know a lot about it. I know how the technologists think. I know how the scientists think. But I can also see the impact it's having on our society. So I want to highlight that. It's another murder mystery. A murder mystery within that context.
Wow. We'll look forward to that, won't we, Mom?
Yes, we will.
Yeah. So we've been speaking today with Mike Nemeth, author of The Undiscovered Country, and covered a lot of ground. The Undiscovered Country. Give us where that title came from.
It's a line from Hamlet. You probably know authors steal everything they can. So it's a line from Hamlet that refers to the hereafter. Actually, if you have the book in hand, if you turn to the very first page, there's a little excerpt from Hamlet. And so it really refers to the fact that if we're honest with ourselves, none of us know what comes next, right? And then there's a bit sort of a double entendre, because the undiscovered country is also about Randall's past and future and what he's going to learn in this book.
Very good. Well, we're out of time. Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
I do. I think this fits. There's an old saying, and I think it's very true. There is no family that can put out a sign which says, there's no trouble here.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Mike.
Well, thank you both. I really enjoyed it.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.